This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's time for the Week in Review, and we'll start with yesterday's mass shooting at the Capital Gazette newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland. Five people were killed. Assistant editor and columnist Rob Hiasen was one of the victims. His brother, writer and columnist Carl Hiasen, spoke with CNN today.
He was the rock of our family. He was the little brother, but he was still the guy who brought all of us together and kept us together when times were tough. He was killed while he was doing what he loved to do, which is to put out this newspaper for the people of Annapolis.
Law enforcement say the suspect, Jared Warren Ramos, reportedly had a longstanding grudge against the paper. Ramos is in custody but not cooperating with authorities. President Donald Trump, who has repeatedly called the media, quote, the enemy of the American people, said today that his government will, quote, do everything in our power to reduce violent crime and protect innocent life.
This attack shocked the conscience of our nation and filled our hearts with grief. Journalists, like all Americans, should be free from the fear of being violently attacked while doing their job.
Well, joining me today in the studio is Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Hi there, Renee.
Hi, Meghna.
Also with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Hello, Tom.
Pleasure to be here.
So obviously, let me just state the obvious. I can't even speak today because this is kind of upsetting. Here we are, three journalists who cover the local news, talking about the murder of four journalists and a sales assistant at a local newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland. So, but let's do our jobs as journalists. And just, Renee, I mean, what's your first reaction to what happened yesterday in Annapolis?
You know, shock and horror. I mean, first, you know, yet another mass shooting in America. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, as a journalist, this hit particularly close to home. You know, and there was this sense of, you know, what was propelling this? What was this? Was this disgruntled employee? Was this, you know, a domestic violence situation? Like, what was this? But in the back of my mind, I just kept thinking about the rhetoric that we've heard, you know, for the last 3 years now about the media. And as you mentioned, you know, an enemy of the people, and the president calling the media sick and calling them scum and all these other things. And you know, so in the back of my mind, I wondered if that wasn't part of what compelled this to happen.
Yeah. I mean, at this point in time, we can't know, right? Because the suspect isn't cooperating. We do know at least that he had some lawsuit against the newspaper dating back at least roughly to 2011. So there are specifics which, ironically, have yet to be reported. But Tom, to Renee's point, it's hard to look at this shooting without thinking of the broader cultural context that she's pointing out.
So if you're in media, you're really aware of the fact that when you write something, you're likely going to get someone angry. And if you don't, if you somehow are not putting out a position that is, you know, is a surprise or something, you're probably not doing your job. All you need to do is read the comments sections, and sometimes they become almost unhinged in terms of the anger that you hear. And the anger is almost because people just don't want something to be said. And I think that's what happened in this case. This is a guy who had filed suit for libel. He lost the suit, as I understand it, the alleged perpetrator here. And his fury was unabated. And indeed, apparently, he had there were standing orders within the newsroom that if he showed up, they were to call 911 immediately. Mm-hmm. He was really known as a threat.
Yeah. Renee, do you have another thought there?
You know, it's worth noting that this man was upset about the newspaper for reporting the truth. These were facts. They didn't make up these details about him. So he was upset with them for reporting the truth. And that really says something. I mean, you know, it's very much what Tom said. You know, I've noticed in pretty much since the election how much nastier my email has gotten. And the comment section, I don't even bother going in. And sometimes it's so bad, I'll get an email from a reader who will say, don't read the comments today. Mm. You know, that's really astonishing. You know, I'm fine with people disagreeing, but this has taken on a whole other level at this point where people are personally attacking you in just shocking terms. And you start to wonder, you know, where does this end? What is the end point for this sort of thing?
Tom?
You wonder, you know, you see this, and is it just people blowing off steam, and particularly because the anonymity of of a comment section gives people that opportunity without any liability, if you know, for what they're saying. But then you see circumstances like this, and there is a reason why to walk into the studios here or to walk into any major media organization now, there's security. Mm-hmm. Because there is some real concern about the people who could come in and be somewhat crazed.
Yeah. Some of the facts of what we know happened yesterday in Annapolis also, once again, just bring about how much damage can be done in a short period of time. Because I'm just seeing here that police are saying that that police arrived within a minute of getting the phone call from someone in the newsroom. But in that 1 minute, five people had been killed. The suspect had barricaded the back door. One person apparently was killed trying to get out of the back door. And they had him cornered in 2 minutes, and yet five people killed. So once again, even to 60 seconds is an infinitely long period of time when you're trapped with a gunman in your office.
Right. And that of course, is the other question, which is the whole gun issue.
Yeah.
And, just bringing it up again. And there was one reporter, I think, for that newspaper who, and I can't say this on the air, but in effect said, we don't need prayers. Mm-hmm. We don't just need prayers. We need something else to be done about the guns.
I just wanted to also mention quickly that as this was going on, the reporters were grieving and scared, but still doing their jobs, still tweeting out what was going on. And in fact, there is a paper out today. The Capital Gazette came out today, and that tells you everything you need to know about the dedication of journalists to get the story right, even when they're under threat. And they are the story. But it was still important for them to get those facts out.
Yeah. So we played that tape of President Trump today saying that this attack shocked the conscience of the nation. Journalists, like all Americans, should be free from fear of being violently attacked while doing their jobs. I appreciated that he said that. But yesterday, NBC News put out video of White House reporters across the White House lawn shouting to the president to get him to comment on the shooting for a full minute, and he walked right by them and didn't say a word. So I'm just wondering, what do you make of the president's statements today?
I think he said what he felt he needed to say. But, a few days ago at one of his rallies, he was ripping the press as usual. So I think it's great for him to say today that the press should not be violently attacked while doing their job, but he has no problem verbally attacking them while they're doing their job.
I wonder what he's going to say at the next rally. That's what because he'll be back amongst his supporters, not standing right at a podium in the White House.
It'll be the same thing he said at the last rally.
Yeah, this is a guy who does not have sort of a quick conscience on things like this. I mean, it's also a year since Charlottesville. Hmm. And, if you remember back then, this is a guy who just does not know how to respond to moments of crisis and say the right thing. And maybe it's just because he doesn't believe the right thing.
Yeah. Well, I salute all the journalists and all the employees at the Capital Gazette, because as you pointed out, they put out their paper today, even amongst the most horrific circumstances. So let's continue to do our jobs as local journalists and switch gear and talk about some local politics here, if we could. They did their job. We can do ours. So we've got a WBUR poll that was put out this week. Still got a couple of months before the September primaries. And we have some results on how people view Governor Charlie Baker, how voters view Governor Charlie Baker. Of course, he's the Republican governor of Massachusetts, but he has better favorability numbers amongst Democratic primary voters than Republican primary voters. And here's some tape from Steve Cazella. He's president of Mass Inc. They conducted the poll for WBUR.
What sticks out to me here is that these are the voters who are supposed to be the most tuned in to Democratic issues, the most tuned in with Democratic candidates, and both compared to Republican primary voters, and especially compared to how they view other Democratic candidates who are supposed to be their own candidates, they just have a very positive view of Charlie Baker.
So if your name is Bob Massey or Jay Gonzalez, that's terrible news for you, Tom Keene, isn't it?
It sure is. I mean, the question is, what election? I mean, this is going to be the dullest election that I think we've seen in years. What's striking to me about this, of course, is that I think part of the reason for this is Charlie Baker is not your traditional Republican, and certainly as the National Party defines itself as conservative. I mean, this is a guy who just signed paid family leave. That is not a Republican platform. That is viewed by many within the party as a tax increase, which he had vowed not to do. I could see a Democrat signing that, and I think that's what Democrats are looking at. This is great. This is actually kind of a Democrat who's managing to get this done.
Which is what some of his Republican critics are saying.
That's why his numbers aren't great among Republicans.
Yeah, Renee?
He doesn't need his number to be great among Republicans because Democrats love him. You know, yeah. The thing that I find really disconcerting is I just don't think enough people realize that this is a gubernatorial election year. And right. That can only benefit Charlie Baker. Yeah. If people have no sense, like, oh, there's somebody else running. I mean, I'm sure you can, walk out of the studio and talk to him on the street and ask them what they think about the Democratic candidates for governor, and they couldn't name them.
Oh, yeah.
At all.
Which is what the polls showed.
Right.
The majority clearly had no idea who these candidates were.
And this
were.
Is supposed to be a very politically astute state.
Yeah. Supposed to be. Right. Exactly. So to that point, though, here's Steve Cazell again from Mass Inc. On what he sees in terms of knowns and unknowns amongst Democratic primary voters.
So these are the voters who should be the most tuned in to the Democratic contest, the most interested in the Democratic candidates. And even there, we find 55% say they've never heard of Bob Massey, 61% say they've never heard of Jay Gonzalez. So still not a whole lot of interest in either one of the candidates.
Those numbers seem huge to me. And is part of the problem here, okay, first of all, yes, Charlie Baker, very popular. I get it. But on the other hand, I wonder if just in Massachusetts, incumbency is like such a juggernaut that it's hard to break through if you're running in a year where there isn't an open seat.
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, look at even something like the mayor's race. I think I read somewhere that there have been four mayors in the last 50 years in Boston. And I think that's the case in Massachusetts as well. I think incumbency kind of crushes everything around it. And people just think, well, it's not, a choice between Charlie Baker and it's just, well, Charlie Baker's been doing a good job and I like the guy and that's it. They're not even thinking about the race. Maybe that'll change through the summer as we get into the fall, but I just don't see it happening.
So let me push back on that a little bit.
Okay.
I agree. There's a power to incumbency. But if you just remember, Joe Crowley lost in New York.
I was just going to say that.
And I think that this is a year where there's a lot of dynamism going on. I don't think Charlie Baker loses, but I also think that this is an unsettled year, and I can see things changing. And I can certainly see them changing in terms of some of the other races that are going on, both statewide as well as some of the congressional districts.
Yeah. So, okay, since you mentioned the Joe Crowley's loss, let's name the person who won, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This is in the 14th district in New York State. She beat Joe Crowley, who was a 10-term Democratic incumbent, who's looking at leadership positions amongst House Democrats. Ocasio-Cortez is a 28-year-old Latina, a Democratic socialist. Here we have tape of her reacting to her win.
I'm hoping that more candidates like me are victorious in their primaries, and I hope that we can focus on getting money out of politics and championing the social, economic, and racial justice and rights of all working class Americans.
So, Renee, after that, all of a sudden, people across the country started paying attention to Massachusetts 7th, okay, with Ayanna Pressley and Capuano.
It didn't hurt that Ocasio-Cortez, tweeted out, vote her in next Massachusetts, meaning Ayanna Pressley. Here we have Mike Capuano, not unlike Joe Crowley, well-regarded, 10-term congressman, but you're also talking about a time when people feel a need to disrupt. And that they may want to change the old guard and just see what else is out there. What's important to also note about Ocasio-Cortez's district that she will likely represent soon is that, it's part of the Bronx, it's part of Queens, including the neighborhood I grew up in, and it is 50% Hispanic. Mm. It is overwhelmingly people of color, and that says a lot. It gets the sense that she got people to the polls who might not have gone there.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge thing. And we might see some of that in the Capuano-Pressley race.
Tom?
Yeah, I think that's clearly what happened in that case that, for Crowley, this was a district that looked like him when he was elected and no longer looks like him. And Capuano faces that
something similar,
somewhat of a similar circumstance for Mike Capuano. There's been a lot of folks who've been trying to go and compare and contrast the race, saying, well, it's really different, and Mike Capuano is more progressive than Crowley was, who was more of a centrist. I still think that Renee's point is really key here, which is that there's a sense of disruption in the air. And I think anything can happen, and including in this particular race, anything can happen.
Well, just since we are talking about Ayanna Pressley and Mike Capuano. We were able to speak with Councillor Pressley this week after New York's primary. We also reached out to Congressman Capuano. He wasn't able to join us. But here's Ayanna Pressley saying that she's encouraged by Ocasio-Cortez's victory, but still believes that she has an uphill fight.
I have no delusions that I will magically inherit a victory, because she was victorious. Ultimately, she won because she worked hard and built a broad and diverse coalition of super voters, low propensity voters, new voters, which is the same thing that we're working to do here in Massachusetts.
But I would also say that one of the big differences, and Tom, you touched on this, is that I think Mike Capuano is taking this race a lot more seriously than Crowley did. I mean, Crowley didn't even show up to a couple of debates.
He sent a surrogate
who didn't know
to a debate.
The positions that the surrogate was supposed to represent.
Right. But having said that, you're also talking about, with Ocasio-Cortez, she was getting no coverage whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, Brian Stetzler on CNN said he hadn't heard of her until 8 days ago. So everyone was kind of ignoring her. But in the meantime, she was doing work.
Mm-hmm.
And she was out there in the neighborhoods, and she built her network of support.
Yeah, and you know, it goes back to one of the big truisms about elections, which they are very much on-the-ground events. And I think you know, we look at national campaigns, and yeah, it's media and so on. She didn't have a big media budget. She had, you know, one really cool ad that mostly ran, you know, was mostly viral and was seen on the internet by folks. But she wasn't on TV. She didn't have a lot of money. She ran an on-the-ground campaign. And even in a congressional district with, you know, 600,000 to 800,000 people, that works.
Right. So just one last observation. Steve Cazella wrote a great piece for WBUR a couple of months ago. We'll have a link back to it at radioboston.org about looking at exit polling demographics from the last election that Capuano won in the 7th. And yes, while it's a majority-minority district, 55% of voters, though, a couple of years ago were white. So not to say that that predicts how it's going to go this time around, but it just reminds me again that, you know, Ocasio-Cortez reached out to, you know, what Ayanna Pressley was calling new voters. And we'll have to see if we do see something similar here. We got 2 months, which is forever in politics.
Yeah, voting's not a mandatory thing. And so it's a voluntary thing. And the key thing for any good candidate is to get people to the polls.
Yeah.
And that's what she did.
All right. Well, let's move over to the next branch of government and talk about the Supreme Court, because so much happened at the U.S. Supreme Court this week. Lots of big decisions, including one on Wednesday regarding public sector unions. And then mere hours later, on the same day, Justice Anthony Kennedy announced that he is resigning effective July 31st. So there is a fight going on already in terms of who's going to replace him. And your thoughts, Renee Graham?
I feel like we should get used to the number 5-4.
Yeah.
We've heard a lot this week, and I think going forward, we're going to continue to hear that. You know, it was a tough week, obviously. I mean, a great week for conservatives, but not a great week for everyone else. And, you know, when you add on to that the fact that Justice Kennedy announces that he's going to be retiring, it felt catastrophic to a lot of people. And the thought that there were some really serious issues that were now going to be at risk, whether you're talking about abortion or gay rights or affirmative action, you know, it's a tough time. It's a really, really tough time for a lot of people.
But on the other hand, a celebratory time for still many others, right? I mean, because, look, a lot of people said that one of the reasons why they voted for Donald Trump, even if they had to hold their nose a lot, was the potential for all of these Supreme Court seats. Mm-hmm. And now that is coming to pass. So if you're Mitch McConnell, you're smiling till the sun goes down, because you held that seat open for a year. You got Neil Gorsuch, and now you got another shot at it.
That's right. I think one of the things I would inject in here, though, is that with Supreme Court justices, you sometimes never know. And, you know, Kennedy was, I believe, appointed by Reagan.
Correct.
And was supposed to be a relatively conservative judge. And he was, really. He was, you know, but he was sometimes centrist. Justices in particular seem to evolve over time. And I think sometimes it's unpredictable. You know, so much so. I mean, Earl Warren, for example, I think that was Eisenhower. Eisenhower couldn't believe where he went. And we may see something like that happen.
You know, so this exact point I put to Nancy Gertner this week, because I said they evolve. They're individuals. The law and the society around them also evolve. So we can't really predict where they're going to go. And she said, yes, historically that might have been true, but she took an issue with that because she said that the nominees that President Trump might put forward are all coming pre-approved from the Federalist Society, for example.
He's not taking any chances with anyone who might evolve. Evolution is not something Donald Trump is interested in. You know, you can have someone who evolves like Kennedy, or you can have Clarence Thomas.
He's just a creationist, I guess.
Exactly. So, I mean, I'm not confident, given what's been going on with the Trump administration, that they're going to take a chance with anyone whose decisions won't fall in line with exactly what they promised their base.
And yet, we still have the Senate. And, you know, the Senate is 51-49 at this point. And it's going to be, you don't have to have a supermajority at this point. You just need to have a vote.
Right.
But there are a number of senators who are kind of in the middle on this one, who you're going to have to persuade. And you can't have, I'll be interested to see what it is, but you can't have an extremist there.
Right.
You're going to have someone who appeals a little bit to the other side.
You're thinking of the Susan Collins of the world?
Yeah.
Well,
Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski. I mean, you have to kind of see where they land on this, but it's really hard to say. Are they going to kneecap the nominee? I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, we'll see. Let's move to talk to at least one or two of the cases, the big cases that the court itself did decide this week. The 5-4 decision, Renee, split along conservative and liberal lines about public sector unions. And the court decided that they cannot compel government workers to help pay for collective bargaining. So we talked to a couple of folks about that. Here's Charlie Chipio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute. And he says that he thinks that the ruling may not have a major impact in some states where there are already certain rules around union fee collecting. But he says it will have an impact here in Massachusetts.
A few states, you know, Massachusetts, New York, California, where organized labor just has outsized political muscle. And in those states, I think this ruling will help level the playing field.
We had Barbara Mataloni sitting right next to him. She's the president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, and she gave a vigorous voice of defense for public sector unions.
What unions represent are working people who put their money together and organize themselves in order to have democratic workspaces and in order to improve the lives of not only working people in their local union, but in their community.
Yeah. Tom Keene, do you think that this ruling will have a major impact in Massachusetts?
I think it's I think we have to wait and see, even in Massachusetts. I think Steve Tolman kind of responded, and he heads up the AFL-CIO here, and really saying we just have to start doing our job a little bit better. And I think there may be ways that you can still make the case to potentially union members that it's still worth their while to join. Maybe you're going to see some diminution of political activity, but maybe not. You may not see as many people opting out as you think.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking back a couple of years ago when Michigan passed its rule against forcing people to – its state-level law against forcing employees to pay for collective bargaining. Union membership there went down by 25% pretty quickly. So some shrinkage, I think, is inevitable.
Yeah, there's some shrinkage. 25% is pretty big, though.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so quickly. And, you know, I always worry about – rulings that seem like they're going to undermine the rights of workers. And I think unions do serve a purpose. I do think unions can be out of control and all of that. But I also think that the idea that somehow unions are the enemy, we've been hearing this for the last decade or so, that somehow unions are bad and unions must be broken. I think this sort of plays into that in a way that doesn't really benefit workers.
One last quick thought I want to get from both of you on this particular case. I mean, there was also the travel ban and the California clinics case as well. So many cases. But Justice Elena Kagan's dissent in this union's case, like, it was like fiery. If I had fire emojis, I'd put them all over the dissent, because basically she used the words that the court has weaponized the First Amendment, because that was the basis on which the majority made this decision. I mean, what do you think? Is this as explicit a cri de coeur as we've ever heard from someone, from a justice, saying you can't use a First Amendment defense on these political cases?
Tom. You're
I'm looking at you, Tom.
Well, I'm just kind of thinking. So, I mean, there is, and, you know, the other First Amendment thing, of course, is freedom of association, too, which is kind of a union type of thing. It's interesting. I didn't see Kagan's dissent, so I can't really say how fiery it was.
I recommended reading, let me tell you.
I have a hard time. I really am skeptical that this is going to play out as badly as people think. And that's and again, we'll see. Maybe I'm right. Maybe I'm wrong. And it drops by 25% in terms of membership, which really would be a bad result for the unions. But I don't think it's I think the unions are going to be able to respond more effectively to this.
Renee,
I tend to err on the side of catastrophe. So, you know, I agree with Kagan. And really, there was so many dissents to read this week. But, you know, she's right. You know, the way this was used, the way they kind of took the First Amendment, and she's right, weaponized it, you know, it was pretty disconcerting, a little nerve-wracking. And you sort of wonder, like, okay, we're going to keep seeing this. And it came up again somewhat in the crisis center decision as well.
The California decision,
right, the California decision. And that's all, the free speech came up. And you know, some people just looked at it and said, I'm not sure about that. But the decision was made. We got 5-4 again.
Well, we have a minute and a half left to go. So can we do to your two quick hubbubs just to round out the week here in pithy but passionate style, Tom?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So today, the state attorney general is crowing about taking down a multi-million-dollar gambling ring. So I have to ask you, are you feeling safer right now? Are you thinking to yourself, thank God those illicit gaming machines are off the streets? I'm not. I suspect you aren't either. And that's because this really isn't about good and evil. This is about a monopoly protecting its turf. As the attorney general herself says, the crime here is that the illegal slot machines were in, quote, direct competition with the Massachusetts lottery. The illegal gaming machines were gunning for the lottery's customers, winning them over, it appears, with a better product, better odds, more convenience, whatever. This is kind of ridiculous. If we're going to allow gambling in the state, and by the way, we long ago crossed that threshold, then anyone should be allowed to go into the gaming business. Regulate it, yes, but don't make competition a crime.
Wow. Renee, we got 30 seconds for your hubbub.
Okay, this week I want to just, you know, talk about the Fowler Clark Epstein Farm, which opened in Mattapan. 30,000 square feet containing collard greens and kale and tomatoes. It's operated by the Urban Farm Institute, and that promotes urban farming and creates green jobs and engages communities in healthier and locally based food. This is open to the public, and it's a wonderful addition to a too often maligned neighborhood.
Oh, terrific. 30,000 square feet?
30,000 square feet. Get your kale.
Awesome.
All right.
Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and WBUR contributor, thank you as always.
Thank you, Mary.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
Have a great weekend, both of you. I'm Agnetha Chakrabarty. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston.